Chapter 19, Jewish Political Supremacy. I will begin by giving you some of the quotations, very powerful quotations, at the beginning of the chapter. And I always like to use the words of other people to make my points for me, people who I guess are far more influential than I am and far more well known and respected. Quote, "The United States has no longer a government of Goyim, Gentiles, but an administration in which the Jews are full partners in the decision-making at all levels. Perhaps the aspects of the Jewish religious law connected with the term government of Goyim should be re-examined, since it is an outdated term in the United States." That's from the major Israeli newspaper, Maariv. Quote, "I've never seen a president, I don't care who he is, stand up to the Jews. They always get what they want. The Israelis know what's going on all the time. I got to the point where I wouldn't write anything down. If the American people understood what a grip these people have got on our government, they would rise up in arms." That was from Admiral Thomas Moore, former chairman of the United States Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this is a quotation from U.S. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. Quote, "The terrific control the Jews have over the news media and the barrage the Jews have built up on congressmen, I'm very much concerned over the fact that the Jewish influence here is completely dominating the scene and making it almost impossible to get Congress to do anything they don't approve of. The Israeli embassy is practically dictating to the Congress through influential Jewish people in the country." In recounting my learning about the Jewish power in the government of the United States, I will skip ahead about 5 years to an event I saw on television on April 15, 1973. Senator William Fulbright appeared on CBS Face the Nation. When, in discussing American policy in the Mideast, he stated very simply, "Israel controls the United States Senate." Since the middle of the 1960s, I knew enough about the pro-Zionist policy of the U.S. government to realize that what he said was true. But I was shocked that he would say such a thing openly. I wondered what impact such a charge would make on the public. After all, he made one of the most sensational charges ever spoken by a United States senator, an allegation with incredible implications, that a foreign power controlled the highest legislative body of America. In a matter of just a few days, Fulbright's accusation of Zionist control disappeared from the press almost as if it had never happened. However, Senator Fulbright, a popular personage in his home state, who had been reelected easily even during the highest patriotic passions of the Vietnam War, he came to oppose the war, suddenly he found himself in hot water. In his next election, he paid dearly for his truth-telling. Huge amounts of Jewish money poured into Arkansas to defeat him, and Jews with any position of influence in business, government, or media, both inside and outside of Arkansas, rallied to help Israel Firster, Dale Bumpers. One of the most remarkable aspects of the affair was that most Jews had liked Fulbright early on because he took a position on the Vietnam War that most endorsed. Jews overwhelmingly opposed the war, from the radical communists in the streets, such as Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, to the influential Jews of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Senator Fulbright dared to say that just as it was not in our true interest to be in Vietnam, neither was it in our true interest to be embroiled in the Mideast conflict. Ironically, many Jews had called Fulbright a hero for casting the lone Senate vote in the early 1950s against continuing the funding of Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy's Permanent Investigation Subcommittee. They owed him a great debt, but all of Fulbright's past support for the liberal policies of Jews meant nothing to them when he refused to pledge unquestioning subservience to Israel. By criticizing the U.S. government's policy in the Mideast, he lost his Senate seat. As I learned about the Jewish domination of the news and entertainment media in the late 1960s, I also came across copious evidence of their enormous political power. I found it to be two-headed. Obviously, through their domination of the media, they have tremendous influence on elections and on public issues. Not only can they influence the public's perceptions by weighting propaganda for or against a candidate or an issue, they can essentially determine whether certain issues will even be discussed at all. The second way they influence politics is more direct. They have become by far the most powerful players in American campaign financing. Their support is crucial to every major candidate. Those who cater to them with the most servility receive support, while support is withheld from those whom they deem less servile. They deliver great rewards for those who play along and politically annihilate those who won't. In the 1970s, I read a Wall Street Journal article entitled "American Jews and Jimmy Carter" by James M. Perry. He wrote, quote, "Jews are generous with their money." The White House's Mr. Siegel, a longtime Jewish employee of the Democratic National Committee, estimates that as much as 80% of the big gifts that sustain the party year in and year out come from Jews. Another article in the Wall Street Journal about campaign financing frankly stated that most of the money of the Democratic Party came from Jewish contributors, and half of the Republican war chest came from Jews as well. Campaign contributions to politicians are like oxygen. They are necessary for political life. Is there anyone who thinks that such money does not buy influence? Because Jewish money and organized Jewish support are so essential, Jewish advisors and assistants also become absolutely vital. Not long after Senator Fulbright's statement claiming Jewish control of the Senate, the highest-ranking military officer in the United States of America, General George Brown, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke candidly at Duke University about Jewish control of the American government, media, and economy. Quote, "We have the Israelis coming to us for equipment. We can say we can't possibly get the Congress to support a program like this. And they say, don't worry about the Congress. We'll take care of the Congress. Now, this is somebody from another country, but they can do it. They own, you know, the banks in this country, the newspapers. Just look where the Jewish money is." Unquote. As I discussed in my chapter on Jewish group strategy, they ethnocentrically support each other until they come to dominate most organizations that they are brought into. Such is also true of the American government. From the advisory roles of Bernard Baruch and Louis Brandeis to President Woodrow Wilson to the complete domination of Bill Clinton's National Security Council, Jewish power has grown steadily as the century has drawn to a close. My awakening to Jewish power came in the mid-1960s. During the administrations of Johnson and Nixon. During the Johnson era, I was particularly aware of Wilbur Cohen, who as head of the Health, Education, and Welfare Department was pushing forced racial integration and the baby factory welfare system that I saw as an inevitable disaster for America. I also knew that Zionist partisan Walt Rostow was one of Johnson's chief foreign advisors, as well as the ambassador to the United Nations, Arthur Goldberg. Despite Richard Nixon's supposedly cryptic anti-Semitic views as exposed by the Watergate tapes, he feared their power and readily placated it. He surrounded himself with high-level Jewish advisors and cabinet members. He made Henry Kissinger Secretary of State and appointed James Schlesinger as Secretary of Defense. Both positions are critically important to Israel. In the economic realm, he appointed Arthur Burns, Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Herbert Stein as Chief Economic Advisor, Lawrence Silberman as Deputy Attorney General, and Leonard Garment as Legal Counsel and Head of the White House Civil Rights Department. The Zionists covered all their bases, as they usually do, by also having key positions in the inner circles of the other party. Hubert Humphrey's closest advisor, E.F. Berman, and Humphrey's 11 largest contributors were Jews. George McGovern's top advisor was Frank Mankiewicz. Now, by the way, on this documentation, you can go to Jewish Supremacism and you will find the direct citations that back up what I say. After Nixon's resignation, Gerald Ford kept Henry Kissinger and brought in an old Stalinist sympathizer, Edward Levy, as Attorney General. And he named Alan Greenspan as his chief economic advisor, who later, of course, became head of the Federal Reserve until replaced recently by another Jewish appointee. Now that's across both Republicans and Democratic lines. Jimmy Carter continued the disproportionate Jewish representation by appointing Harold Brown as Secretary of Defense and adding a troop of the Chosen to the National Security Council and important economic positions. Reagan and Bush added to the Jewish onslaught with the appointment of a host of other Jews to positions throughout the bureaucracy, always reserving many key roles for Jews in foreign and economic policy. From the early days of the 20th century, Jewish power has steadily progressed to the point where it's now breathtaking in its scope. As their power became more entrenched, the Jewish-dominated media found less need to deny its clout. In fact, they may find it somewhat to their advantage to boast of it so they can make sure that no goyim will dare challenge it. The major Israeli newspaper, Maariv, ran a story called, quote, "The Jews Who Run Clinton's Court" on September the 2nd, 1994, in which it boasted of the dominant Jewish makeup of Clinton's advisors and cabinet. It quotes a prominent Washington rabbi to the effect that the government of the United States is no longer a government of Gentiles. It bears repeating, quote, "The U.S. has no longer a government of goyim, Gentiles, but an administration in which the Jews are full partners in a decision-making at all levels. Perhaps the aspects of the Jewish religious law connected with the term governor goyim should be reexamined. It's just an outdated term in the United States. In other words, my friends, it's no longer a government of us, it's a government of them." The article boasts of their complete domination of the administration and describes many top officials around the president as, quote, "warm Jews," unquote, upon whom Israel can always count. And here's a direct quote from the article. "In the National Security Council, 7 out of the 11 top staffers are Jews. Clinton had especially place them in the most sensitive junctions in the U.S. security and foreign administrations. Sandy Berger is the deputy chairman of the council. Martin Indyk, the intended ambassador to Israel, is the senior director in charge of the Middle East and South Asia. Dan Shifter, the senior director and advisor to the president, is in charge of Western Europe. Don Steinberg, the senior director and advisor to the president, is in charge of Africa. Richard Feinberg, the senior director and advisor to the president, is in charge of Latin America. Stanley Ross, the senior director and advisor to the president, is in charge of Asia. The situation is not much different in the president's office, which is full of warm Jews. The new attorney general, Abner Bikvi, the president's schedule and programs manager, Ricky Seldman, deputy chief of staff, Phil Leida, economic advisor, Robert Rubin, media director, David Helzer, staff director, Alice Rubin, Elie Siegel, in charge of volunteers, Ira Mezina, in charge of the health program, two cabinet members, labor secretary Robert Reich and Mickey Cantor, in charge of international trade agreements, are Jewish. They are joined by a long list of senior Jewish officials in the State Department headed by the head of Middle East Peace Team, Dennis Ross, and followed by many deputy secretaries and even more senior secretaries, chiefs of staff." Dennis Ross, by the way, of course, was the chief negotiator of Camp David. That deal they said the Palestinians should have taken, which was a horrible deal, moderated or negotiated and refereed by Dennis Ross, the man mentioned here, a warm Jew who's 100% in favor of Israel. You know, in most soccer matches or most football matches in the United States, you never have referees representing the other team or from the other home team's turf. And yet somehow we're supposed to have good mediation in the Middle East by having radical Jewish supremacists being the negotiators. Let's go on. Bar Yosef begins the article by pointing out that these warm Jews, dedicated Zionists, who every day go over the most secret intelligence information presented to the President of the United States. One wonders why Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard is locked up in federal prison when extreme partisans for Israel, such as Sandy Berger, have daily access to America's most secret intelligence. Even in my college days, it was obvious to many people that the Jewish lobby had a tremendous impact on Capitol Hill and in the White House. A real dichotomy existed between what the politicians would do and what they would say. Even though Nixon ran on a conservative platform which emphasized issues such as victory in Vietnam and opposition to forced busing, his administration began the first affirmative action programs. Although he gave lip service to ending busing for racial integration, he appointed the officers of the Attorney General's office who continue to push for it in courts across America. His Jewish Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, helped frame the Paris Peace Accords that led to the inevitable victory of the Viet Cong and a peace with dishonor, making meaningless the sacrifices of hundreds of thousands of American fighting men. Interestingly, many of the same dovish voices decrying the napalming of Viet Cong soldiers were Israeli hawks, cheering the use of the same weapons on women and children in the Palestinian refugee camps. The Israeli newspaper also makes it clear that effective Jewish control includes both Democrats and Republicans. Quote, incidentally, although the Jewish power in the current Democratic administration is so huge, there are also many warm Jews heading the top positions of the Republican Party. And of course, and that's unquote, and of course we've seen that recently, it's a side note, not from the book. We've seen that obviously in the creation of the Iraq War, a war for Israel, not for America. The primary use of Jewish power in Washington, obviously, is to promote Jewish and Zionist interests, such as our pro-Israel policy. In that area, Israel has all her bases covered. The president's top security advisors, such as Sandy Berger and Leon Perth, are dedicated Zionists, and they have Jews in the critical positions of Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. When the United States mediates Middle East peace talks between the Palestinians and the Israeli Prime Minister, Dennis Ross is the chief arbitrator, a nice, as they say, warm Jew. Is it any wonder that Palestinians feel that they are not getting a fair shake when the so-called mediators of the conflict are as dedicated a bunch of Zionists as are the official representatives of Israel? The hypocrisy goes on and on. Salon Magazine, in February 17, 1997 article by their Washington correspondent Jonathan Broder, a writer for the Jerusalem Report, by the way, had this to say, quote, Washington, following the recent revelations about Madeleine Albright's Jewish roots, the new U.S. Secretary of State faces a new conundrum. All her top candidates for a slew of senior positions in the State Department are Jewish and male. A number of foreign policy experts have been quick to note the exquisiteness of the irony. It suggests that we've come a long way in this country from the days when the Foreign Service was reserved for very WASPy elite, says former National Security Council Middle East advisor Richard Haass, who now directs foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. As a side note, my friends, you see, this goes right along with what we're talking about in terms of takeover of Russia during the Bolshevik Revolution, except this was not quite as a bold takeover as that, but it's just been a very quiet and but very powerful subversion of our government, a removal of us from the positions of power and a placing of themselves in the positions of power. Yes, there are many Gentiles. George Bush apparently is a Gentile. But let me tell you, these guys know where their bread is buttered. Let's go on. When Albright traveled to the Balkans, she attacked the immorality of Croatia for not allowing refugees to return. But she makes no similar moral demands for Israel to allow the return of the million Palestinian refugees it's banned for decades. As any group seeking power would understand, economic prowess is the next important component of control after directly administered political power. Jewish power in the economic processes of our country is practically monolithic. Many of these positions, of course, change from time to time, but as of this writing, in the last term of President Clinton, Jews hold all the most powerful economic positions. The most powerful position of all is the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and it's interesting to note that this critical economic appointee, Alan Greenspan, has remained in office through both Republican and Democratic administrations. And as a side note, of course, he's replaced. It's a Jewish seat by another Jewish supremacist. And this will, I'm sure, continue as long as they hold power in Washington. Are Americans so naive as to believe that this cohesive, ethnocentric people of immense wealth do not share information and network with their brethren for their own benefit? In the section on Jewish economic strategy within my upcoming chapter on the roots of anti-Semitism, I point out how in the economic sphere, early knowledge of government policy or access to other privileged government information is worth countless billions of dollars in the marketplace. As I discovered these things, I asked myself, do these economic czars have an opportunity to advance their own common interests? Does not reason suggest that they have pressed their own economic interests in the same way they have advanced their interests in America's pro-Israel policy? Jewish interests go far beyond Israel and economic policy. The top advisors of the President of the United States influence every area of American life, from welfare to taxes, immigration to criminal justice. Imagine and consider their influence on the appointment of federal judges alone. In my own federal court district, the Eastern District of Louisiana, which has only a very small Jewish population, Jews constitute a third of the sitting federal judges. On the Supreme Court of the United States, there are currently 2 Jews and 7 Gentiles. Jews often have had specific agendas in the areas of civil rights, immigration, feminism, homosexuality, religious beliefs, the arts, gun control, and many other areas of American life. Invariably, they have insinuated themselves into positions of great power and influence, which impact government policy on those and many other issues. It is not only President Clinton's top advisors and counselors who are Jewish. Vice President Al Gore's chief of staff is the Jew Ron Klein. So we can say that they're even prepared to mobilize in the event of the president's death or impeachment. Perhaps one of the most telling indications of the special status of Jews in the U.S. government is the startling fact that Clinton has officially appointed a position of, quote, special representative to the Jewish community, unquote. Jay Futlick's position is a unique one, as there are no, quote, special representatives for any other ethnic, racial, or religious group. There is no representative exclusively for the Irish, the Germans, or Italians, or for that matter, even Christians. But there is one for the chosen. And it's easy to see why, when one considers their incredible power. It is a power clearly understood by every president of the United States. A partial list of the key governmental position occupied by Jews appears in this chapter. This is listed by no means their complete power. Who knows how many bureaucrats are like Madeleine Albright, Jews who expect us to believe they didn't know that they were Jewish until after appointed to office. The Spotlight newspaper, as well as Dr. Errol R. Fields, The Truth at Last, and I have publicly talked about her Jewish pedigree over the years, for many years, before she supposedly knew of it. One of the many low points of the Clinton administration was the pandering of the White House Lincoln bedroom for big campaign contributors. The newspaper Jewish Week proudly reports that, and I quote, "There was a definite Semitic aspect to the list," said Johns Hopkins University political scientist Benjamin Ginsburg. In fact, half or more of the White House visitors listed were Jewish, from the new DNC, Democratic National Committee chair, and former president of the pro-Israel lobby, Steve Grossman, to superstar singer Barbara Streisand. That result is hardly surprising, given the special character Democratic Party fundraising, Ginsburg said. Unquote. Not only do Jews exercise great power inside the government bureaucracy and diplomatic corps, they also have disproportionate power in the lobbying organizations that most influence government. The 3 most powerful foreign policy lobbying organizations on Capitol Hill are pro-Zionist organizations, and the heads or the key administrators of many other special interest groups are Jews. They also have influence in many foundations and organizations that in turn affect politicians and government. They include groups such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, and many more. Of course, they wield immense power in the press, such as Katharine Meyer Graham's Washington Post and the Sulzberger's New York Times, as well as having immense influence in television. Without question, the Jewish-dominated media constitute the most powerful governmental lobby in the world. Jewish power in government media has grown so great that they appear to think that they are unassailable. Upon the re-election of Bill Clinton to the presidency, Jewish Week, which is the largest Jewish newspaper in the United States, by the way, on January 24, 1997, reported a gathering in Washington, D.C. at the Jewish Community Center for, quote, a Jewish leadership celebration, unquote. The article makes the case that in years past, quote, Jewish leaders would not be so bold in celebrating Jewish political involvement. Their worry was that acknowledging Jewish successes would only reinforce anti-Semites. Jews feel secure enough in their accumulated clout. Politically, we've come out of the closet, comfortable enough with our own achievements to celebrate them openly. The Jewish community has reached a kind of critical mass in politics that guarantees that many of the gains of the Clinton years will remain no matter who occupies the White House. Unquote. No matter who occupies the White House, they boast, their immense power will remain. Are they implying that no one could even attempt to become president without subservience to their power? If that implication were made by Gentiles, it would certainly be viewed as anti-Semitic. Perhaps the most telling barometer of whether the American government has become what some refer to as a Zionist occupational government, or ZOG, is Jewish representation in our diplomatic corps. If, after all, the government is in reality a Jewish occupational government, it certainly stands to reason that its key representatives overseas would reflect that fact. Now, here's an amazing list of Jewish ambassadors as of 1997, which does not include the multitude of Jewish bureaucrats and under-ambassadors serving lower-level positions. North America, Mexico, Jeffrey Davidow. Canada, Gordon Griffin. Cuba, diplomat Michael Kozak. France, Felix Roetten. Belgium, John C. Kornblum. Germany, Alan Blinken. Denmark, Edward Elson. Norway, David Hemelin. Sweden, Thomas Siebert. Switzerland, Madeleine Kunin. Poland, Daniel Fried. Hungary, Donald Blinken. Romania, Alfred Moses. Belarus, Kenneth Yalowitz. Turkey, Mark Grossman. Egypt, Daniel Kirstner. Israel, Martin Indyk. India, Frank Wiesner. New Zealand, Josiah Beeman. Morocco, Mark Ginsburg. South Africa, James Joseph. Singapore, Timothy Korba. Brazil, Melvin Levitsky. American emissaries to its three closest neighbors, Canada, Mexico, and Cuba, are Jewish. Their Ambassador Griffin, Jeffrey Davidow for Mexico, and our U.S. interest diplomat for Cuba is Michael Kozak. In the Middle East, American has Jewish ambassadors to both Israel and Egypt. Jewish diplomatic hegemony is equally impressive in Europe. And I just gave you those figures, but here's an example. Switzerland was successfully blackmailed by Edgar Bronfman's World Jewish Congress over supposed Holocaust bank accounts. America's Jewish ambassador, Madeleine Kunin, helped Bronfman. The New York Times on October 4, 1997, reported that she, quote, doggedly pursues the Swiss on the issue of gold for Holocaust survivors. Again, these are American ambassadors. They're Jewish supremacists. And again, they're pursuing, first and foremost, the Jewish and the Israeli agenda. Just as they have come to be key advisors and appointees of the President of the United States, Jews are accomplished at their Jewish partisan team politics in the lower echelons of power as well. They hold a vastly disproportionate share of positions of influence in groups from social clubs to labor unions. Their domination of many labor unions is an ironic display of their power, for no group in the United States is less disposed to physical labor. Such leadership may explain why union administrators have often sold out their overwhelmingly European-American membership by supporting programs such as affirmative action and taking only half-hearted actions in opposition to free trade and immigration. Once in positions of great power, they are not reluctant to use their positions to advance an agenda that often conflicts with the interests of the overall membership. In my campaigns for the U.S. Senate and for Governor of Louisiana, Jewish officials would steer diametrically opposed groups to oppose me, no matter what my record was in relation to those groups. Jews in labor are anti-labor organizations. Environmental are industrial associations. Pro or anti-gun control would use their influence in those organizations to promote their own political agenda against me because of my policy in Israel. That agenda was only concerned about Israel and not the fundamental issues represented by the associations they supposedly represented. This section is called A New President, Same Jewish Agenda. In the election of George W. Bush to the American presidency in 2000, it had little effect on the overwhelming Jewish power in the American governmental bureaucracy. Although the Jewish establishment overwhelmingly supported Al Gore for president, it knew that Bush understood the political necessity of following political agendas set by supremacist Jews. Powerful Jews such as Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan continued to span both Democratic and Republican administrations. Although the Jews lost some of their more visible positions in the new Bush administration, the underlying Jewish-dominated civil service bureaucracy has continued, with a multitude of Jews holding critical undersecretary and deputy positions in the State Department, Pentagon, CIA, and other important agencies. Even President Bush's primary public spokesman is appropriately Jewish. Press Secretary Ari Fleischer even shares the same ethnically derived first name as Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. And I'm a recent director of the National Affairs Domestic Policy of the American Jewish Committee, probably the most powerful Jewish organization in America, Dr. Steven Steinlight, wrote an essay in October 2001 about the Jewish orchestrated American immigration policy. It reveals much more than Jewish attitudes in immigration. It also exposes widespread sentiments of Jewish supremacism and power. And by the way, before I go on, as a side note, this is again a slice of time, but in just the last few months, President Bush has appointed Josh Bolton, a radical Jewish supremacist, to head up the White House. And he heads White House policy. And he even sets policy admitted by organizations and groups. And his second command is also Jewish. And they're now having meetings of Chabad Lubavitch, one of the most radical, vicious, racist, anti-Gentile organizations on the face of the earth. An organization that maintains and believes that Gentiles are part of the animal kingdom, that the entire purpose of the Gentile world and all the world is simply to serve Jews, whom they believe have the DNA of God. In other words, they are walking gods in the face of the earth. And the purpose of Gentiles is simply and totally simply to serve Jews. One of the Chabad Lubavitch well-known rabbis recently in St. Louis, and this is an article that he wrote for Jewish Week, again, the largest Jewish paper, wrote that is it moral for a Jew who needs a liver to stop a non-Jew on the street and take his liver? Is that moral? And he answers basically in the affirmative, that the Torah would allow this. This is the kind of attitudes that they have. And these people are being celebrated in the White House, including their famous, what they call Great Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson, who is celebrated and honored in the White House of the United States. Now, in his article, The Jewish Stake in America's Changing Demography, Steinlight writes a preeminent Jewish role in changing American immigration policy over the last century to the point where whites will now become a minority in America. He expresses fear that the change is now occurring so fast, although multiculturalism has been a big advantage to Jewish power, it will pose a threat unless it's allowed or slowed to allow for Jewish propagandizing of the new arrivals. He's especially concerned about Muslim immigration, arguing that their voting and lobbying might pose a danger to Jewish Mideast agenda. In making his case to his fellow Jews, he speaks guardedly, but makes some amazing admissions about Jewish power in America. And I quote, "While Jewish sensitivities continue to enjoy extraordinarily high levels of deference, and while Jewish interests continue to receive special protection, does it matter that the majority of non-European immigrants have no historical experience of the Holocaust or knowledge of the persecution of Jews over the ages and see Jews only as the most privileged and powerful of white Americans?" Unquote. Steinlight goes on to write about what he sees as a threat to Jewish power and even indirectly reveals why Jews prevent real campaign finance reform, which of course is favored by an overwhelming number of Americans. Quote, "Not that our disproportionate political power, pound for pound, the greatest of any ethnic cultural group in America, will erode all at once or even quickly, unless and until the triumph of campaign finance reform is complete, an extremely unlikely scenario. The great material wealth of the Jewish community will continue to give it significant advantages. We will continue to court and be courted by the key figures in Congress. That power is exerted within the political system from the local to national levels through soft money and especially the provision of out-of-state funds to candidates sympathetic to Israel." And as a side note, just as the money came in by the millions to my opponents in Louisiana, even for the governorship of Louisiana, because I would dare to oppose Armitage's policy. He speaks frankly about the incredible power of the Jewish-controlled media. Quote, "It is also true that Jewish economic influence and power are disproportionately concentrated in Hollywood, television, and in the news industry, theoretically a boon in terms of the formation of favorable public images of Jews and sensitizing the American people to issues of concern to Jews." Unquote. He even confesses the rampant Jewish supremacism of which most Gentiles are completely unaware. And I've made this quote many times, but it's so important. I hope that you listen very closely to every word here. Quote, "I confess it, at least like thousands of other typical Jewish kids in my generation, I was reared as a Jewish nationalist, even a quasi-separatist. Every summer for 2 months for 10 formative years during my childhood and adolescence, I attended Jewish summer camp. There each morning I saluted a foreign flag, dressed in a uniform reflecting its colors, sang a foreign national anthem, learned a foreign language, learned foreign folk songs and dances, and was taught that Israel was the true homeland. Immigration to Israel was considered of the highest virtue, and like many other Jewish teens in my generation, I spent 2 summers working in Israel on a collective farm while I contemplated that possibility. More tacitly and subconsciously, I was taught the superiority of my people to the Gentiles who had oppressed us. We were taught to view non-Jews as untrustworthy outsiders, people from whom sudden gusts of hatred might be anticipated, people less sensitive, intelligent, and moral than ourselves. We were also taught that the lesson of our dark history is that we could rely on no one. Of course, we also saluted the American and Canadian flags and sang those anthems, usually with real feeling, but it was clear where our primary loyalty was meant to reside. Now, that's unquote, and if any Gentile dared to say the typical Jewish kids are taught that their real loyalty is to Israel rather than America, and the Jews teach their children that they're superior to Gentiles in intelligence and morals, he would be condemned and hounded out of politics as a, quote, anti-Semite. Yet these are the precise words used by the head of the Domestic Policy Division of the American Jewish Committee. And his words were not some offhanded or careless conversation where he didn't mean to say or he said something different than what he meant. These were his carefully chosen words from a major article he wrote for Jewish consumption. Steinlight even speaks frankly about one of the traditional methods of Jewish power, divide and conquer. And I want you to note that the wording is similar to many other Jewish writers. They write as if they were at war with the Gentile world. And perhaps they are. Quote, for perhaps another generation, an optimistic forecast, the Jewish community is thus in a position where it will be able to divide and conquer and enter into selective coalitions that support our agenda. Unquote. I guess I'm supposed to be an anti-Semite because I'm one American citizen who prefers that our nation not be divided and conquered. Jewish political tactics similar to those used on a local and national level are employed in the international arena as well. Jews in critical positions in the U.S. government can use their influence to blackmail other nations of the world to support Israel. Foreign aid, trade status, and other U.S. policies are used like a carrot and a stick to coerce other nations to support Israel's position in the United Nations. Zionist influence is also used to buy off with huge expenditures of American taxpayers' money as foreign aid Israel's enemies, such as Egypt and Jordan. Jewish power in government and media has also prodded U.S. military actions against Israel's more implacable enemies, such as Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi. America, with her great might, has become a surrogate, strong-armed enforcer for Israel and the Jewish people worldwide. The tail truly wags the dog. And as a side note here, I want you to note that one of the most radical, virulent Jewish supremacists in the world, the man who orchestrated the Iraq War as much as anyone, Paul Wolfowitz, radical Jewish supremacist, he was put ahead of the World Bank, a person that controls countless billions of dollars of funds. Everyone around the world, every country knows his positions on Israel, and they know that if they don't please Mr. Wolfowitz, or if they have a position on Israel that Mr. Wolfowitz wouldn't like, they're not likely to get those billions of dollars or aid or loans. And you can imagine how that would affect their votes and their reactions to certain Israeli interests in the United Nations and elsewhere. Next section is the anti-American war against Iraq. President Bush proved to be completely under Jewish power when he dutifully went to war against Iraq on behalf of Israel, a war clearly against every true interest of the United States. When America, under its Zionist controllers, went to war against Iraq in March of 2003, the world was told that war was necessary because Iraq violated United Nations resolutions. In fact, Israel had violated far more resolutions, almost 10 times more than had Iraq. Bush launched a war against Iraq supposedly because it had weapons of mass destruction, This while Israel had one of the largest arsenals of deadly chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons in the world. America went to war against a nation that never raised a finger against the United States, while it sent more billions and more weapons of mass destruction to Israel, a nation that undeniably had committed murderous terrorism and damaging espionage against the United States. And as I've said earlier as a side note, recently, since this book was published, Israel's even had ceremonies recognizing and calling heroes Jewish terrorists who terroristically firebombed American installations in Egypt, trying to get us into war with that country. And Israel's had ceremonies celebrating the terrorist actions against the British when the bombing of the King David Hotel, kind of a mini 9/11, and they were celebrated. And at least Britain offered some complaints and some protests about that celebration, but our government didn't offer a word of protest about Israel, the country we send billions to, celebrating terrorist acts against an ally, a treacherous act trying to get us into a war which would have betrayed American interests in every way. Only Jewish domination of the American media and government enabled such obvious hypocrisy in the Iraq War. There probably has never been a war more clearly against the interests of the United States than the Iraq War of 2003. It has made hundreds of millions of people around the world hate us. It's put our brave military men in harm's way. It made Americans more likely to suffer from future terrorism. And it's come at a huge, financially devastating cost of hundreds of billions of dollars, and which, by the way, will be trillions of dollars over the next few years. Of course, Jewish power can be used for many self-serving reasons. In Switzerland's battle with Edgar Bronfman's World Jewish Congress, Zionists in the United States used our government to successfully blackmail the Swiss into capitulating to Bronfman's extortion of $1.2 billion by threatening to have the United States government shut down Swiss banking in the United States. Jews even use city governments in the blackmail effort. New York City, as a center of banking, can severely punish the Swiss for failing to accede to Jewish demands. To quote the Times-Picayune of August 13, 1998, quote, "A number of cities and states in the United States have threatened to impose sanctions on UBS AG and the Credit Suisse Group if they did not agree to an acceptable settlement." When I began my previous chapter on the Jewish domination of American media, I asked, what if the Iraqis, who supported Saddam Hussein, controlled the American media? Americans would correctly see the situation as dangerous to our freedoms and our national interests. Suppose for a moment that the same Iraqis that were loyal to Saddam had the most powerful lobby in Washington, were the top national security advisors of the president, and practically controlled the economic policies of the United States. No true American patriot, aware of the alien domination, would tolerate it. Is the situation any less tolerable that these men and women are not Iraqis but fanatical Zionists loyal to Ariel Sharon, reared in a catechism of anti-Gentile Jewish supremacy and completely dedicated to the most racist nation on earth? Few in America seem to ask these important questions. The silence is understandable, however, when one identifies the tribe who decides what questions are to be posed and what facts are to be given to the American people. It is also understandable considering the real-life examples of the political consequences of telling the truth about Jewish supremacism and power. Men such as Senator William Fulbright, Senator Charles Percy, Representative Paul Findlay, Pat Buchanan, and I have paid a high price for frankness and honesty on this issue. Congressman Findlay wrote an excellent book detailing the incredible intimidation and suppression exercised against those who stood up against the Israeli lobby. The book is called They Dare to Speak Out. Perhaps the Jews have every right to try to influence the American government and its policies. But we, the great majority of the American people, have the right to demand that our government be ours and not theirs. The right of self-government is basic to all political freedom. A government manipulated against the best interests of its people on behalf of a tiny minority is called tyranny. When some of my friends in the patriotic movement coined the aforementioned term Zionist Occupation Government, or ZOG, I thought the term a bit extreme. But after much reading and thought, I realized that it was a rather apt description of the sad state of affairs in Washington, D.C. The quotation from the Israeli Ma'ariv newspaper should send a shiver up the spine of every loyal American. I will quote it for the third time, and I will do so again and again in my political life until the American people understand its gravity. Quote, the U.S. has no longer a government of Gentiles, but an administration in which Jews are full partners in decision-making at all levels. Perhaps the aspects of the Jewish religious law connected with the term government of Goyim should be re-examined, since it's an outdated term in the United States. Unquote. So America no longer has a government of Goyim, a government of us. And the only ones who make a point of saying it publicly are Zionists boasting for the edification of their fellow Jews in Israel. It is my belief that there are still millions of Americans who, if they have the opportunity to read these lines, will become as angry as the character of Howard Beale in the movie Network. They will become mad as hell, and they will do whatever it takes to change things so the next generation of Americans will not have to take it anymore. The human instinct to protect one's family, race, and nation is called patriotism. It beseeches us to oppose any alien group seeking the control of our nation's government, whether it be Zionists, Iraqis, Germans, or even theoretically the fanciful notion of invaders from outer space. Such impulses are not anti-Semitism, but simply good patriotism. We have every right to stand up for ourselves, just as Jews stand up for themselves. Stephen Steinlight, the AJC director, who I have quoted extensively, put it in elemental terms. He wrote, quote, we rightly ask, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? In America and the Western world, only Jews are allowed to exhibit true patriotism. For those of us whose patriotism dares to go beyond enjoying the fireworks of the 4th of July, we are attacked relentlessly. Jews who seek to exert control over other nations are never condemned, but we Gentiles who simply express the natural desire to have our own nations reflect our own traditions, values, and interests are branded as anti-Semitic, racist, supremacist, and hateful. Such hypocrisy has always been the essence of their strategy and a weapon used in the exercise of their power. Another weapon has been their ability to control language, and it's time we probe into the real reasons for the misused word in the modern world, the word anti-Semitism. The next chapter is chapter 20, The Roots of Anti-Semitism, Economic Exploitation.